From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot to get to today when we get back from the news, because the acclaimed classicist Mary Beard is our guest, and her new book covers 1,000 years in the story of ancient Rome. Beard can explain what it was like for everyday Romans in their heyday. The Romans had a few heydays. Beard says, think of a city of more than 1 million people, a sprawling mixture of luxury and filth, of liberty and exploitation. But in her book, she goes back further, in fact, way back to a time when Rome was a dinky, insignificant settlement on the River Tiber. Beard looks at the myth that gave Rome a beginning and Roman people an identity. And we'll talk about how this very ordinary town came to be the center of an empire and what it was that made the Romans special. Join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the acclaimed classicist Mary Beard, joining us to talk about her latest project, A History of Ancient Rome. And it's hard to imagine it now, but this was once an insignificant, ordinary village in central Italy. It became, of course, the center of the ancient world, a sprawling and noisy and filthy metropolis of more than 1 million people. And Mary Beard says this ancient version of Rome is important because it underpins Western culture and politics. She's joining us to talk about her book. It's called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And we invite you to join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mary Beard is a professor of classics at Cambridge University in London. She's also a blogger, a BBC presenter, and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. She's the author of numerous books, including The Fire of Vesuvius and Confronting the Classics. And she's joining us today from the studios of radio station WHYY in Philadelphia, where she's currently on book tour. And Mary Beard, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
I want to begin with, you point out in your book that you have spent a good deal of the past 50 years of your life exploring the first millennium Romans. And I guess I wanted to ask why. What is it that got you started with the Romans?
As an expert, some people think it's rather sad that I've spent 50 years, you know, with my head buried in the past. But I suppose I got, from a time when I was quite young, I got fascinated by the Romans. I don't think they're particularly nice. I don't think they're admirable. I wouldn't want to go back and live in ancient Rome. That'd be absolutely awful. Right. What they tell us about themselves, what they thought about, the problems they faced, really has always seemed to speak to me. And they've left so much behind them. I mean, it's easy to get the impression, I think, that 2,000 years ago, that, you know, we're really dealing just with very few scraps of evidence, a little bit here, a little bit there. There's more writing surviving from ancient Rome than anybody could actually read in the course of a lifetime, you know, and that goes from science fiction to pornography, not to mention philosophy and history and poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
So, there's plenty to keep you going.
Well, you in fact say that we know more about ancient Rome than the Romans themselves did.
Well, in a way, I think that's true, because the other reason, I suppose, that keeps you, you know, going with Roman history is that there's always more stuff coming up. There's more things and more new techniques that help us, you know, get under the skin of the Romans, sometimes, you know, actually quite literally get under the skin. One of it's my favourite example of new science is a discovery made about 10 years ago now, which is actually a cesspit under a block of apartments in the town of Herculaneum, which is not far from Pompeii, destroyed by the volcano in 79 AD. And in the cesspit is literally what went directly from the lavatories of the apartment block into this hole underneath them. And so what we're seeing is still preserved there, exactly what went through the digestive tracts of the people living in that building. So we can really see exactly what they were eating. And it's quite easy to get the impression, if you read Roman literature, that Roman food was always frightfully exotic. You know, they were eating dormice stuffed with honey and anchovies, you know, served on a bed of snails and lettuce. In fact, looking at what comes out, what you can still see in what is effectively 2,000-year-old excrement,
yeah,
it is not like that at all. It's fruit and figs and pomegranates and chicken and eggs and pork and a real lot of fish. And it does seem, and this is something we just wouldn't have known, it does seem that these people in Herculaneum were very keen on sea urchins,
mm-hmm,
because there's an awful lot of little sea urchin needles in this leftover excrement. You imagine it might have been slightly painful, but
you know, my favorite bit is the samples from the drilling from the ice cap in Greenland, which showed that the Romans polluted like a lot of civilizations did, I guess.
Yeah, you can dig down or drill down now meters and meters into the Greenland ice cap, and when you get to the level of the ice that was formed in the Roman period, what you discover there is the kind of pollution that isn't seen again for 16, 17, 1800 years. And it's a wonderfully vivid trace of Roman industry, honestly, and it's probably largely made from the enormous mining works that they had in Spain. I mean, we often see Roman coins in museums. You know, where do they get the silver from? Well, the answer to that is largely from Spain, and the byproducts are still turning up if you dig down far enough in the ice cap in Greenland. Mm.
There was a time, you say in your book, when you thought that modern societies could learn directly from the Romans, but you don't feel that way anymore. You think it's a sort of what you think you say in the book is that there was no simple Roman model to follow to do that. But what you're interested in, you say, is there is a lot to learn by engaging with the history of the Romans, and you describe it at certain points in the book as kind of a conversation. Mm. Would you explain that?
Well, I think that I used to think, and you can still often see it in newspapers, you know, headlines saying, you know, we ought to follow the Roman example here, and we ought to, and then anything can follow, not invade Iraq, you know, you know, eat more porcupines, you know, whatever, you know, anything will then come up.
Yeah.
And sometimes the advice that's given in those things, if only we knew what the Romans did, we'd do it better. Sometimes the advice itself is not bad, but actually we don't need the Romans for it. I'm afraid we're on our own. Mm-hmm. We've got to make our own decisions. And the fact that the Romans did or didn't do something is almost neither here nor there. And you certainly wouldn't want to copy them in, you know, all kinds of respects. And there is no way that I would like to be a woman in the Roman world. But that said, you really can see Romans hardly talking about problems that still mean something to us. What is the rights of a citizen? What counts as liberty? In what circumstances is it legitimate to suspend civil liberties? And you can also see them, in a way, doing things so differently from us that it helps you think about yourself from the outside. I mean, so I think in learning about the Romans and in thinking about why Romans did some things that we don't do and acted differently from us, mm-hmm, I think we learn both about them, but we also start to see ourselves in a different way. And I remember being very struck. This was a long time ago when I first realised that the Roman judicial and punitive system didn't have prisons. There were a few things in the Roman world called prisons, but that was simply where you were held before you were executed. And they had no idea of a custodial sentence, as we do. Now, what I think about that is, we don't necessarily want to say, oh, so we should abolish prisons then. But I think it's wonderfully, it's kind of wonderfully stimulating to us to see that there's a culture which doesn't take for granted some of the things that we do take for granted. Yeah. We couldn't imagine the idea of punishment without incarceration. Now, just remember, there were some cultures that did it differently. Now, so we don't necessarily want to say, therefore, we should abolish prisons. But it's just that it's a push and an irritant to us to make us see ourselves from the outside. Mm. And I think that's what I've enjoyed finding out more about the Romans. I've enjoyed reading what they wrote. I've enjoyed kind of getting angry with them sometimes. But I've also enjoyed the process of finding out about us that goes along at the same time. But I don't think, there's no Roman model that we should sit down and follow, please.
Yeah.
otherwise, I'd be losing my vote.
I do want to come back to that idea of there being no custodial system in the judicial system, because it brings this – we'll come back to Julius Caesar making this remarkable recommendation a little bit later in a story, just a moment. But let's talk about the title of your book first, which this comes from a popular Roman catchphrase, SPQR, the Senate and people of Rome. Right. What is it about that catchphrase that expresses what you're getting at here in the book, do you think?
Well, partly it's longevity. I mean, you still see it all around the modern city. SPQR, the Senate and People of Rome, is still on the trash cans in the city of Rome, and it's still on the manhole covers, and it's sort of the longest running abbreviation in history, I think. But it also is a wake-up call for us, because it's what the Romans called themselves. When they thought about who they were, they didn't just say, we're the Romans, they said, we're the Senate and people of Rome. And that's a good reminder that we shouldn't forget the people. It's always proved very easy to tell the history of Rome as if it was a history of big men making decisions, going out and fighting people and running the world, as big men like to think that they do. And what I'm wanting to do, and it was one of the reasons for using their own description of themselves, was to say, look, the Senate, that is the governing class, they're important in the history of Rome, of course they are, but don't ever forget the people. And I've wanted to write a history which, as far as possible, and of course there is less evidence about the people because, they don't write the books that we can still read. Mm-hmm. But I've wanted to keep the people in the picture, just like the Romans did.
It's so many myths, I think, that we hold from Rome. And you mentioned some of these. I wanted to just mention a couple of them. They had no grand plan. I mean, the idea that Romans had a big plan for conquest didn't really work like that. And in fact, you say, and this was intriguing to me, the motivations behind their military expansion, which was extensive, as I think we all know, is still one of history's great, great mysteries. So what do you mean? We don't necessarily know what it is that motivated them to keep growing the empire, I guess?
Yeah, I think we don't know that. We can see by the time we get to, let's say, the era of Julius Caesar, the late 1st century BC, we can see that they are beginning to have a view of their own expansion as something that was divinely ordained. The gods wanted them to have an empire.
Right.
But if you go back to the beginning and look at when they first started to expand, you don't see any trace of that. Mm. And I think it's all too easy to to get the impression that this group of rather posh Romans sat down one day with a map and said, right, you know, so how do we start on our grand plan of world conquest, Julius? You know, now, actually, nothing like that ever happened. And one reason it didn't happen is the Romans didn't have any maps for a start at that point. So they couldn't start to plan the next stage of their conquest. And it's not even clear, as other people have liked, I think, sometimes to imagine, that the Romans were more brutal or more militaristic than their neighbours. I mean, the bottom line truth about people living in the ancient Mediterranean, Greeks, Romans, whoever, is that they are all militaristic.
Right.
You know, it's a world that is run on force, and force is the ultimate guarantor of power. We're dealing without a world without international courts or Geneva Conventions or whatever. It all comes down to fighting things out. And the question that I wanted to raise is not exactly, or specifically not why, so why did the Romans do it? But why did the Romans win? Everybody in this world is at fighting. They're all doing it all the time. But, you know, an old teacher of mine used to say, you should never say in the ancient world war broke out. What broke out was peace.
Right.
You know, war is the normal state of affairs, and occasionally you get a moment of peace. So the question that I wanted to ask was, so why were they so successful? Because that is really what is causing their first entry onto the world stage. And it became clear to me really that they become successful because they have more boots on the ground. Roman battles, ancient battles, are not usually won. Occasionally they are, but they're not usually won by better equipment or better tactics or better determination. They're won by the number of soldiers that you can actually put on the field. And Rome very quickly gets a very, very large military force for one reason only, and it's something that Rome does differently from any other of her neighbours. And that is, when she beats somebody in warfare, Rome doesn't just, you know, go back home again and take a few slaves. Rome starts to incorporate the people that she's beaten into the Roman project, making them citizens very often, citizens of Rome, or making them allies. And the sole obligation of those citizens or allies was to provide troops for the Roman army when called. And so as Rome expands, it becomes a self-fulfilling and self-fueling process, that the more people she conquers, the more boots she gets on the ground, and the more people she conquers again. So that by the time you get to the 3rd century BC, one pretty much contemporary observer says Rome can actually call on 700,000 soldiers. Now, at that point, Rome has become invincible. I mean, Rome can lose battles, but it becomes very hard for Rome to lose a war because Rome has such depth of resource. You know, it can lose a battle and bring up another 10,000 soldiers.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways that's the nub of it, really.
Right. Before we head to a break, I wanted to mention just one more myth that you refer to in the book, and that is this idea that Rome was just sort of the ugly stepchild of classical Greece. That's another myth that I think we hold, that the Romans were just sort of the thuggish, the copiers of Grecian ideals.
Yes. I mean, we imagine ancient history as being, on the one hand, very nice intellectual people in Athens who are watching theatre and inventing philosophy and democracy.
Right.
And on the other hand, this bunch of thugs who are inventing roads and concrete, but otherwise being pretty brutal. And insofar as they had culture, they were just copying the Greeks. And in some ways, that goes back to what the Romans said of themselves. They constantly thought about how they related to the Greeks, whether they were better, whether they were worse, whether they were inferior, and how they could exploit Greek culture for themselves. But I think it's a terribly crude view, both of the Greeks and the Romans. I mean, the Greeks were as vicious and nasty as the Romans. And if you look at what the lovely Athenians with all their theatre and philosophy did when they had an enemy, it was, you know, massacre the lot of them if they could, just as bad as anything the Romans did. But also Rome is a culture that quickly becomes, in becoming bigger, it becomes interestingly more complicated than Greek culture. And the number of Athenian citizens in the 5th century BC, it is glory phase, you know, is really the size of a large university campus now. Rome, and the city of Rome itself, never mind the empire, by the 1st century BC, has got 1 million people in it.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with complexity, with difficulty, with a whole series of actually extremely intellectual attempts to deal with law, how to run a human community, how to define what the rights of a citizen are, define civil liberties and so forth. Just as interesting and just as challenging, I think, as anything that Athens got up to. You know, though, not that I want to dish Athens, but just to remember it, you know, it is a bit more complicated than we often take it to be.
Mary Beard is with us, Professor of Classics at Cambridge University. She's the author of the new book, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the acclaimed classicist Mary Beard. We're talking about her new book, which covers 1,000 years in the story of ancient Rome. And she goes way back, in fact, way back to the point when Rome was an insignificant settlement on the River Tiber. And she looks at the myth that gives Rome a beginning and Roman people their identity. The book is called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And she's joining us today from radio station WHYY in Philadelphia, where she's on book tour. So your history, you go way back, as I just mentioned, but really the book begins in the middle of the 1st century BCE, in 63, to put a fine point on it. This is some 600 years after the city is founded, but you start there. Explain why do you start there?
Well, quite a lot of reasons. One is that I wanted to start with some real good meaty evidence. Because, you know, if you go back to the very beginning, it really is, it's fascinating, but it's a question of putting together the tiniest little hints that you get, little traces of archaeology, little traces in later literature. And there's a terrible kind of downer effect, I think, of always having to say, we don't know, that we don't know this, we don't know that. Now, I think in some ways it'd be quite liberating to say, we don't know. But I think for the first chapter of a history book, it was likely to put people off. So I was looking for a place where people could really feel what the rich texture of Rome was like. And I quickly decided that a big conflict between Cicero, mm-hmm. one of the leading Roman officials of the state, in 63 BC, and his enemy, Catiline Lucius Sergius Catilina, who Cicero accused of what we would call terrorism, actually, mm-hmm. wanting to overthrow the government and destroy and eliminate the elected representatives, that conflict would really get people started in seeing why the history of Rome was interesting. And that's partly because we still have the speeches that Cicero, texts of the speeches that Cicero gave and denounced Catiline in. We have a little essay written about it very shortly after the event. And we have Cicero's letters, copies of them still preserved in describing what he was doing. So we really are at the kind of the richest bit of Roman history. But it's also a bit of Roman history that I think can't fail to speak to us. Because what Cicero does is he claims to have identified a terrorist plot. He claims to have revealed who the criminals are. He hounds the leader, Catiline, out of town, and then he rounds up his associates, all of them Roman citizens, and he executes them without trial.
Right.
And at the end of that, he is, to start with, lauded as a hero. He has saved the state. But very quickly, doubts are raised about the legitimacy of his actions. There was a rudimentary version of a Homeland Security Act, which Cicero claimed gave him the right to suspend the civil liberties of the conspirators and simply to execute them without due process. But normally, the basic principle of citizenly protection in Rome was that a citizen was entitled to a free and fair trial. And soon Cicero's enemies gang up on him on precisely that charge, and he is forced briefly, admittedly only briefly, into exile. And the site of his house is destroyed in right. Rome, and the site of his house is used for a shrine of the goddess Liberty. Now, that can't, I think, fail to resonate with us about our own dilemmas. And they're, you know, they are, I think, insoluble dilemmas, which the Romans found equally insoluble, of how far is it legitimate for the officials of the state to suspend civil liberties, to suspend the rights of trial, freedom, in the interests of homeland security and the state, the safety of the state. Mm. And we see Cicero and his friends and enemies and historians later in Rome ever after grappling with that issue. Was Cicero right to kill the conspirators because that was what was necessary to keep Rome safe? Or was it a gross and flagrant breach of the whole principle of the liberty of the citizen? And that's our problem too sometimes.
Right. Going back to Julius Caesar in this encounter, he's the one that makes a suggestion that, I don't know, was he serious that they be imprisoned, even though they didn't really have a system for that, I don't think.
Yes, Julius Caesar, it's one of his earliest entries in 63 BC into the, you know, into the big world of Roman politics. And in discussions in the Senate, it is said, and it's reasonably well documented, the historian writing about this knew Caesar and was writing quite shortly afterwards, that Julius Caesar makes the extremely radical suggestion that Cicero should not execute the conspirators, but he should imprison them for life. And if that's true, and I think there's a very, very good chance that it's true, it would be at the absolutely first example we ever have of the idea not just of life imprisonment, but that imprisonment effectively was a punishment. It would have seemed even more radical in Rome than it does to us.
Gives you a sense of how clever Caesar might have been too.
Smart guy, yeah. a genocidal maniac when it came to his campaigns in Gaul, I'm afraid, but a smart guy.
Yeah. I wanted you to say something about the encounter that Catiline has with Cicero in front of the Senate, because you do mention it as this kind of template for political conflict that still kind of exists.
Yeah. As the stories tell us, and Cicero's own surviving speeches imply, that you have a really major standoff between Cicero and Catiline in the Senate when Cicero is going to denounce the terrorist enemy.
Right.
And the speech that Cicero gave, the main speech which really forced Catiline into exile and apparently kind of revealed the whole plot to the surrounding senators, is still read, and it is still studied not only in universities and schools, but it is still part of modern political rhetoric. He starts out by saying the very first words, "How long are you going to go on abusing our patience, Catiline?" And in that phrase, in Latin, quo usque, tandem, Catalina, etc., that phrase is constantly reused in political conflict. Now, I mean, it was only, I think, last year that Senator Cruz used the whole speech, almost, in an attempt to attack President Obama. He just took Cicero's words and inserted Obama instead of Catiline, I seem to remember. And the whole idea of how long are you going to abuse our patience is used against François Hollande in France, almost any leader. And it's worth just going to Google and Googling how long are you going to abuse our patience. And you'll come up with the most amazing array of instances. And the one that I found most touching, in fact, was a photograph when I was just before I was getting down to write this book, photograph of some demonstrations in Hungary against the Hungarian president. And I was just flipping through the newspaper and suddenly my eye caught this picture and the banner that the protesters were carrying. And it wasn't just how long are you going to abuse our patience? Yeah. It was actually written in Latin, quo usque tandem, yeah, it said, on this banner. And I thought Cicero would be so immensely pleased, you know, that, you know, how he formulated that sense of opposition, argument, standoff between one side and another was 2,000 years later still being used down to the exact words by us. Amazing.
And even the techniques of the speeches of Cicero, you say they remain models of great speech making. We can find some of these techniques in President Obama's one, for example.
Yeah. Yes, it's always said that both Obama and his speechwriters have spent a long time studying the basic rhetorical tricks of Cicero's speeches, you know, the strategic repetition, you know, how and when to come to an end, you know, how to press your point home. And in many ways, Cicero's own rhetoric still underlies how we think a good speech goes even now.
When we come back from a break, I want to talk about the founding father of Rome, Romulus, this myth you work through in the book. But let's stay on 63 BC for just a moment, because you do write about, you describe the city, as you mentioned before, more than a million people there, mixture of luxury and filth and liberty and exploitation is how you put it in the book. But you give us a sense of what it was like on the street. You know, you talk about the bricks and stones and lots of winding streets and dark alleys, and it must have smelled horribly at moments. And, I mean, just give us a sense of that, if you would.
Yeah, seedy, noisy, and smelly would sum it up, I think.
Right.
I think what we've got to do is get out of our heads the image of Rome that Hollywood's given us, or the image of Rome I think we get when we shut our eyes and imagine, you know, the city of Imperial Rome, marble, planned, rather elegant, grand, possibly a bit oppressive, big public buildings. Rome eventually became a bit like that. 50, 100 years after the moment of Cicero, you know, in his standoff with Catiline, Rome would have looked much more like that. But at this point, you know, in some ways, at almost the height of Rome's imperial power, before it has an emperor, but when it has effectively got all this enormous amount of overseas territory, it is a ramshackle, unplanned, brick, local stone, dirty place. So if someone like Cleopatra, for example, who is known to have come to Rome at around the same time, if Cleopatra had come from her city of Alexandria, which was very grand but slightly faded on the world geopolitical stage, yeah, but still very, very plush, I think Cleopatra would have been amazed that the city that now effectively ran the world was such a mess. It was big, It had some high-rise buildings, but it had very little in the way of services. And you know, it was probably extremely dangerous to walk down the streets at night, not just because you might meet some nasty muggers, but because there'd be people throwing out the contents of the chamber pots on the head of passers-by because they had nowhere else to put them. And it was nothing like the imperial capital that we imagine, and which, to be fair, it did become.
Yeah.
But it had not yet got an imperial capital that matched its overseas holdings.
I hadn't realized Cicero was a slumlord till your book.
I'm afraid Cicero was an extremely naughty man when it came to exploiting his tenants. There's one lovely occasion when he says, "Oh dear, I've got this block of flats, it's absolutely terrible. Even the rats have departed." But we have to imagine, I'm afraid, that the tenants were still there.
Mary Beard is with us. Her new book is SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mary Beard. We're talking about her book, her new book, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. So let's talk about the myth, of course, I think a lot of us are familiar with, about how Rome comes into being. This the image of a wolf mother suckling a baby Romulus and his twin brother Remus. You say in your book that this is one of the oddest historical legends anywhere in the world. Pretty strange. Would you put it in perspective for us?
Well, first of all, most founding legends don't have a pair of twins. There are some others that do, but most don't. And we have a rather cosy image, I think, to start with, of Romulus and Remus, because the poor kids, they're exposed, they're abandoned, and they're found by the wolf and suckled. Mm. And that image of the wolf with the little twins underneath has become a very favourite symbol of the city of Rome. But what happens next gets even odder. Because when they go to found their city, Romulus and Remus, many years later, obviously they're grown men, though young, they have a row. They have a row about exactly where they're going to put the city. They've come to the site of Rome, but exactly which hill is it going to go on is something they have a squabble about. And in the course of this squabble, Romulus kills Remus. So not only do you have twin founders, but you have one twin murdering the other. And that was something that the Romans themselves talked a lot about. They'd invented this myth. I mean, Romulus and Remus are entirely fictional characters. There was no such people ever existed called Romulus and Remus. But the idea of that story went back a long way in Rome. And Romans saw that the original fratricide, the original murder of brother by brother, as something which, in a sense, stood for Rome's capacity, repeated capacity, to fall into civil war. One of the things they thought marked the city of Rome was not just its expansion, but the fact of internal fighting in the state too. And so that story of murder is a story which, in a sense, roots and gives an ancestor to Rome's civil conflicts throughout its history. But it goes on to get stranger and stranger in some ways, because Romulus, having killed Remus, finds himself as the leader of the new tiny little settlement. And he's got a few mates, but he hasn't really got any citizens. So what he does is he declares his city, his new city, I mean, it's just a hill, it's not really a city yet. Yeah. He declares an asylum and says, anybody can come here. Runaway slaves, criminals, refugees, everyone's welcome. You can come and be a Roman citizen wherever you're from, whatever you've done. So you see, and this is has again quite a resonance, particularly in the problems of citizenship and migration, especially in modern Europe. Romulus founds his city as one that welcomes all comers.
Yeah.
The city is founded as a city of asylum seekers. And just to finish off the strangeness and slightly uncomfortable side of this story, which
are you getting to the rape part?
I'm getting to the rape, I'm afraid, which is a part that the Romans also worried about terribly, as you can understand. Romulus manages to get men this way, so he's got a city of men, but he hasn't got any women.
Yeah.
And the story is, of course, the city won't survive unless he's got women, because he needs kids. And he goes around the surrounding towns and villages, and unsurprisingly, none of the people there want to give their daughters to this band of runaways and criminals that Romulus is so proud to have attracted. So the only way he can get women is to have a trick. And he invites the neighbouring people to a nice festival in Rome. And in the middle of it, he blows a whistle and the new young citizen Romans just grab the women that have come. And it's many of the people come from a country called Sabinum, and they're the Sabines. And this is the famous rape of the Sabines. Mm. The men just grab their wives. And this was something that Rome worried about and was anxious about ever after, because in a sense, what we're seeing here is the first Roman marriage. These Sabine women are going to be the wives of the young Roman citizens. This is marriage. And Romans asked, in a way that reminiscent of much of the feminism that I was brought up on, is marriage always rape? It problematized the whole nature of marriage by saying it started off as rape. So what's the difference, they said, between rape and marriage? Is this something we should feel ashamed of, or is, in a sense, marriage always rape? And it's strikingly and unpredictably has an unpredictably feminist side to that question. Mm. I think.
You know, you work us through in the book the sort of this period, the regal period, when there was a period of kings, and this kind of gets us to the concept of liberty. That's where, I guess, where we sort of end up in this. And it raises the questions, if the Greeks thought of democracy first, and I wonder if that's entirely true. It seems like the expulsion of the Roman kings came around at the same time, I think you point out. Yeah. Did Rome give us the concept of liberty if the Greeks gave us democracy?
Yes, I think they did. Rome, after they've got rid of their kings, something which also follows another particularly unpleasant rape, after they'd got rid of the kings, they instituted a broadly democratic system. They never called it democratic, but all men had citizen rights, and those included the right to vote, and they elected their officials annually by a process of popular election, and the assemblies of the Roman people, which voted on laws and on who was going to be the main officials of the state, were in our terms broadly democratic. But it was the Athenians who kind of got there first with the word, even if they didn't get there first with some of the ideas. But what Rome would always go on about was the nature of liberty. Right. And it was really, it goes back to, and it's what's at issue in Cicero's conflict with Catiline and the execution of those conspirators without trial. The Romans were particularly interested in what the liberty of the citizen amounted to. What protection being a citizen gave you, what rights it gave you. And they clustered those rights all together under the slogan of liberty. And that would include, obviously, the rights to a fair and free trial, but it also the right not to have degrading punishment, such as crucifixion. No Roman citizen was supposed ever to be crucified. And various rights to economic independence, and to independent decision-making about things like marriage and making contracts, a right to be a functioning person. Mm-hmm. So liberty is probably more than our own version of liberty. It's the package of rights and privileges that go with being a free citizen.
And this gets to the idea of this constant conversation, because it's not as if the Roman Republic begins in a moment. I mean, the truth is, as you sort of describe it in the book, it's born slowly and very slowly, in fact, reinvented many times over. And so these questions the Romans are asking themselves, oh, what is liberty? What is the nature of liberty? Yeah. That's the thing that they're constantly working through, I guess.
Yes, I mean, they have a story that the Republic and their system is invented overnight. They get rid of the kings and, you know, snap their fingers and suddenly they've got this kind of quasi-democracy. And it took much, much longer than that. And they're all the time working through those notions of liberty. And in ways that we now have, we still inherit. And I think in many ways, people in the United States are much more aware of issues of liberty for obvious historical reasons than people in the United Kingdom. You have to do a bit of work with people in the United Kingdom to make them see that liberty is in some ways at the root of their political system. You know, happily citizens of the United States are much clearer about the importance of liberty in a constitution and in a state's history. It's one of the reasons it's quite nice to be here, because talking about the Romans in the United States is often a richer experience than talking about them in the United Kingdom.
I guess for some obvious reasons, among them being sacked by the Romans too, I guess.
Yes.
It's a bit of a problem.
Yes. Well, although on the other hand, you know, people in, where I come from are always very proud, even though they were the defeated in some ways, always very proud of the Roman remains in their backyards, you know, that we're all brought up with a local Roman town and we cherish the kind of the traces of the Romans, and, you know, our transport system, like it or not, is still very largely a beneficiary of that Roman capacity that we all know about to build roads.
Right.
You know, our roads are still Roman roads, but we're not so sensitive about liberty.
Right. Well, the trajectory of your story, of course, encompasses a thousand years. You end your story in 212 of the Common Era, Caracalla, I don't know if I've pronounced that right.
Yes.
Roman emperor, I suppose, gives all free inhabitants Roman citizenship. So they're working out this idea of citizenship, takes them 1,000 years. They finally, in some way, get to it in 212. Talk a little bit about this, because once everyone is granted citizenship, you say, in some ways, it becomes irrelevant.
Yes, it's a real puzzle. The first thing I think you have to see is that whatever the reasons that lay behind what Caracalla did, it was an absolutely extraordinary event. And I really hope that one of the things my book might do is put the year 212 on the map a bit, because it was giving citizenship to perhaps 30 million people at a stroke. And there has never in the history of the planet been a grant of citizenship of that on that scale. So it's a momentous turning point. And we have no idea why Caracalla did it. And, you know, by all accounts, Caracalla was a bit of a nasty piece of work. And he did this the year after he'd murdered his younger brother, who was sitting on his mother's lap. So he wasn't simply a peace-loving liberal. And the Romans and modern historians have never been able to work out what it is that drove Caracalla to it at that moment. But it does, in a sense, finish the Roman citizen project. Citizenship has been gradually being extended to more and more people in the provinces, and this finishes the job. And in some ways you'd like to cheer and applaud that, and in part I think I do, but it isn't the end of the story. It's not a triumphal ending, because as soon as everybody is a citizen, perhaps not surprisingly, the Romans start to invent all other kinds of distinctions between the privileged and the unprivileged, which somehow make citizenship in part irrelevant. And you start to get a division between the rich and the poor in the Roman Empire, when the poor become, in a sense, as unprivileged as non-citizens were before. So in some ways you're getting the very, very first glimpses, I suppose, of the kind of hierarchies that you see later in feudal medieval Europe, with the haves and have-nots and greater rights, by far going to the haves than to the poor. So it's a triumphalist ending, undercut, and I hope piquantly undercut by what happens next.
Over time, the city of Rome, of course, comes to be eclipsed as the center of power. It falls to invaders in the 5th century a couple of times, of course. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Gibbons talks about the fall of the Roman Empire. It doesn't seem to have worked out like that. It seems to have just kind of petered out. Is it fair to say that?
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, the city of Constantinople, modern Istanbul, goes on being the capital of the Roman Empire until 1453. Mm. So if you look at it from the point of view of the eastern Mediterranean, there's another 1,000 years of life left in the Roman Empire. We tend to call it the Byzantine Empire, mm-hmm. but it is the Roman Empire. In the west, it peters out, but it doesn't peter out in quite the way we imagine of a sort of appalling standoffs between horrible, dirty, crude and uncultured barbarians and the remaining pockets of civilized Romans. You get a dispersal of power. Rome itself doesn't any longer represent a serious political center. But even the people that we think of as horrible barbarians often still think of themselves as inheritors of the Roman tradition. They go on speaking Latin, they write Latin poetry, they foster and develop Roman law codes. And in some ways, what you get in the West is a kind of whole series of mini little Romes who are much smaller, but still culturally, even if not politically, linked to the great inheritance, as they would have seen it, of the Roman Empire.
Mary Beard, her new book is SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. She joined us from Philadelphia, where she's currently on book tour. Mary, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Lindsay Vickers is our intern. Josh Weathers is the producer of Video West. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.